Jesus, thank you for everything that you are and everything that you have done, that you continue to do, and that you will do in the future. We find our rest, our identity, our forgiveness, and our hope in you alone. And we worship you. Amen. Please do be seated. I find the older I get, the closer to me this music stand needs to be. It's very concerning. Okay. So just a reminder as well, I should have said earlier that next week we've got a baptismal service. So we're really looking forward to that. So if you have people who sometimes say to you at work or neighbours or family who say, I might like to come to church sometime, next Sunday would be a great Sunday to invite people who aren't used to being in church. So do join us for a baptismal service here at 10:30 next Sunday. And I mentioned to a few of you that I felt God speaking to me during the week about some things about the austerity cuts and the church's place in the financial crisis. And I thought I was going to do that this morning, but I decided not to do that. So we'll pick that up at a future time. But pray for me. I'm getting some glimpses about this horrendous financial crisis we find ourselves in as a country and how we should be responding as a church. And I look forward to talking about that at some point in the future. But this morning, we're going to finish our series on making money. Make money has been something we've been looking at for the last 3 or 4 weeks. But let me just stop for a moment. And before I do, I just need to say, I want to inaugurate a new award at Maybridge Community Church. I think we should have a monthly award to the Man of the Month. We're going to have a Man of the Month award here at Maybridge. Now, the criteria for this Man of the Month award is when men do things around the home, DIY, or, you know, with their wives or with their children, which just make all the other men look great. Okay, that's the idea of them. So, wives, I want you to submit, children, I want you to submit your nominations for the Man of the Month Award, because we have got two cracking Man of the Month contenders this morning. Ian McKinna. God bless Ian McKinna. Ian McKinna texted me a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you never guess what? He said, I walked my daughter to school with the dog and was in the playground, tied the dog up, took my daughter into the classroom, came home without the dog. The dog is left tied up on the school railings. So he's and then about 20 minutes later, he says, you're never going to believe this. They called the RSPCA. I've just had a call from the RSPCA. They want to see me. They've got my dog. And then another 20 minutes later, and he said, it wasn't the RSPCA. It was Nettie and her work colleagues. They thought it was funny. So that is nomination number one, Ian, for Man of the Month Award. The second nomination for Man of the Month Award goes to a certain Dr. Martin Rolfe. Now, I don't know why Martin didn't tell me this story himself, but it has come to the pastor's attention that some of you know that Martin keeps sheep, and one of his sheep died in tragic circumstances. So, you know, looking to make good use of the time, he invites his seven-year-old daughter, to come to the abattoir with him and the dead sheep for a date. And apparently a traumatized Joanna says at the end, Daddy, I love you very much, but never take me there again. So if we can have a quick vote on who we think was Man of the Month. Okay, you know, no, it's a democratic sort of situation. So anybody thinks Ian is Man of the Month? Who thinks Martin is Man of the Month? Yes, round of applause for Dr. Martin Rolfe. That's a beautiful piece. And do keep those nominations coming in for April. Right, enough of Man of the Month. But actually, one of the things I love about church is that, you know, there are these things which bond us together. And when it comes to this issue of money, we actually really are all in it together. I recognize that we're in a community of people where some people have plenty of surplus and other people are struggling to make ends meet. But actually, there are some things about what money which genuinely do mean we're all in it together, as I hope this morning will make clear. So this is where we've been over these last 4 weeks. As in that first week, we've spent all 4 weeks in Luke's gospel looking at how we need to make money a joint account with God. In Luke 18, making sure that money is our slave, not our master. Joe was talking to us last week about how generosity is part of the character of God and what he wants to do in us with our money. And then this morning, we're going to be looking at Luke 16, making money see God's kingdom come. But I need to keep saying this. I am conscious that every time we talk about money, there is immediately static in the air because it is such a painful issue for so many people. There is a challenge for Christians to make money do different things for us than for everybody around us. But it does hit a wrong nerve for some of us who, you know, desperately would love to work. For others of us who experience benefit cuts this week, for some of us who are in small businesses and you're being completely screwed over by a large company that has kept you in debt for months and months and months. For those kind of situations, talking about money can be incredibly painful. There is a great dignity about earning money. We're called to make money to live our lives. But it also is an issue of great pain. But I can't stop talking about it in church just because it's painful, as I hope you'll see from this passage. Luke 16. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. And Jesus continues his teaching in verse 11. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not, and if you have been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. And he said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight." Man, there's some strong words. Let's unpack them together. Anybody see this in the news this week? In the brickfield part of the City of London, they're doing these deep excavations in preparation for building a new building. And preserved there in the river mud have been found thousands of Roman artifacts dating back to the first century AD, 2,000 years old. And here is a perfectly preserved leather Roman sandal from the first century. Astonishing. Just found in the City of London. And go on the BBC website and you can see thousands of these Roman artifacts, all, you know, in pristine condition because they've been preserved so well in this clay mud of a now dried up river. I show that at the start because when Jesus was speaking about those kind of issues with money, it was a very different financial climate to our culture today. That gap of 2,000 years can't be underestimated. They didn't have disposable income. They didn't have pensions. They lived close to the land, and many of them in subsistence farming. There would have been bartering of goods, which was a normal part of the of culture. They were under a huge tax burden from the Roman Empire. In the church, Christians that followed in the early church in the book of Acts and so on, they didn't have any church buildings or full-time ministers. And if we're honest, the Bible is completely silent about many of the details about how do we manage our money, how do we balance the what do we keep for ourselves and what do we give to the church and what do we give for others. There are no verses which tell us what kind of car we should have, what kind of house we should live in, what kind of holidays we take. There is just a vacuum of silence in the Bible about that stuff. You know, there is no verse which says, and lo, you shall only ever ride on second-hand donkeys. You know, or there's no verse which says, and lo, you should only ever have two pairs of shoes. Most husbands are still looking for that verse, but anyway, we haven't found it yet. It doesn't say in the Bible, you shall have no more than four bedrooms. It doesn't say in the Bible, and if you have a loft extension, you're going to hell. You know, those kind of passages are completely absent. So we must be very careful not to just condense 2,000 years and take one situation that was as it was then and a very different situation now. What we have to do is look in the Bible for principles that transcend time and culture. And this passage that we've just read is important because it gives four really important principles about money for people in any generation and in any financial circumstance. This is as true in the slums of Calcutta in India as it is as true in Beverly Hills, as it is as true in Worthing, as it is as true in any other part of the world. These principles transcend culture. So what are they from this passage, Luke 16? The first one is this, principle one, if we're Christians, we are stewards, not owners. The question for God at the root of everything to do with money is this: can you be trusted with what God has entrusted to you? Can I be trusted with what God has entrusted to me? What do you own? Just have a quick mental kind of sum up. When I say, what do you own? What springs to mind? You know, property, possessions, bank accounts. What do you own? And if your mind's starting to race there, it's a trick question. What Jesus does here in this passage is he assumes a radically different view of everything that we think of as ours. Jesus insists that everything belongs to God and that he has entrusted us with a loan, and he wants to see what we do with his stuff. Verse 12 says it explicitly. And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? We are all stewards. When I was 17, I had just passed my driving test, and I went to stay with my grandparents in Devon. And I took a friend with me, and I persuaded my nan that she could lend me her car to drive in. I would pass my test and I was a safe driver. And my lovely nan, she agreed to this. And the next morning, it was a beautiful sunny day and we were going to go to the sea, go to the beach. And I got in this car and I wanted to see how fast it would go on the Devon country lanes. And that journey didn't go very well. And I remember having to come home that evening with some damage on the bodywork of the car and having to explain to my nan that she had trusted me with this and I had not been trustworthy. It was terrible. It was an awful experience. In fact, I can still feel a bit of telling the story now. I had betrayed the trust that had been entrusted to me. How do you know if you really know that you're a steward of what God gives you, that he holds us accountable for what we do with his stuff? Nothing we have is ours. It's all his. How do we know? Well, you'll see it in our gratitude for everything we do have. When people are thankful, we realize that we don't receive life as an entitlement. It's a gift. When we're content with what we have, when we're generous with others because we know that it's not ours. Right at a foundational level, whether we're in poverty or whether we're in wealth, God has entrusted to us certain things. We are stewards. We need to get serious about thanking God for his blessings, because it's part of how we shape our minds to recognize that I'm not owed anything. It is a gift. Some of you know Donna Goddard, and Donna Goddard's great phrase in life is, "Aren't we blessed? Aren't we blessed?" If you speak to Donna for more than 20 seconds, you can guarantee that that line is going to come out. Aren't we blessed? It's a mindset of this. Everything that we have is not ours, it's God's. We're stewards. The cancer of our society is entitlement, that we think we're owed stuff. That's dangerous spiritually. We need to learn this whole idea of gratitude, which reflects stewardship. Linda Rollinson was telling us recently as a staff team that she was in Jerusalem, and she bought one of the original widow's mites. You know the story of the Bible when a lady has absolutely nothing and just brings that widow's mite? Well, here is an original widow's mite. Or at least that's what Linda says. There was probably some Arab salesman who thought, she looks a pushover. I did this with a baked bean can a few years ago. Let's see if she... And anyway, sorry, Linda. That whole idea of whether we've got nothing or whether we've got everything, an extravagant generosity, which is a reflection that what we own is not our stuff. The second principle is that money is a rival God. Verse 13, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Please, please, please listen to what I'm about to say. Please note that this does not say that it is a sin to earn a very good salary. It does not say it is a sin to be very rich. Some deeply spiritual Christians are entrusted with great wealth and are called by God to use it powerfully for his kingdom. What it says here is you can only have one driving force in life, only one primary motivation. If it's making money, God will have to play second fiddle, and he refuses to do that. And if it's God, money has to become a servant of God. We can have both God and money, but you just can't serve both God and money. And then Jesus finishes the passage with a saying which emphasizes the danger. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight. David Cameron a few years ago was ridiculed for his line when he said, "We're all in this together." Really. The whole thing about the austerity challenge. But it is true for Christians. We're all in this together, whether we have very little money, not enough money, or a great deal of money. Just like the early church, where slaves and masters worshipped in the same congregation, so in a church like this, we have everybody on the economic spectrum. But we are all in it together in these senses. These principles transcend. We are stewards. We don't own anything. And money is a rival God as much as it is to the poor as it is for the rich. It's where our orientation is that counts. We're all in a battle to make money work for what we believe. And the Bible backs up this teaching of Jesus in these passages here. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, said Timothy. And Hebrews says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. It's a danger to us. The third principle is that money is a question of honesty. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. Jesus makes clear that scrupulous honesty about money is crucial for any follower of his. It's honesty which makes us trustworthy. And both Paul and James in the Bible remind us that we can deceive ourselves. Honesty needs to start with us. We run rackets with ourselves about money. We kind of play little tricks of the mind and we don't catch ourselves. We don't realize we're not actually being honest with ourselves. Like the age-old con, which is, oh, I'll start giving to God just when I've paid off this. Well, that day never comes. There's always something to be paid off. It's a little racket we run in our minds. Or there's the racket which says, in a church situation, oh, there are wealthier people than me in the church. They can pay for the things that need to happen. Actually, it's not about them. It's about us. Because this is a rival God who needs to be defeated. This is about worship and worship. We give to God a reflection of what he is worth to us. We're wanting to recognize that all we have is his. It's not about them, it's about us. Most of the rackets that happen in giving to God is in the middleman. You know, God doesn't have a bank account that you can pay directly into. I remember when Isaac was a lot younger. Do you remember this? We were waiting outside church one day. Your mum was talking. We were ready to go home. And Isaac had done a colouring in church. And he said, how do you give things to God? And I wasn't paying attention, actually. I didn't see he had a picture. And I said, oh, you just pray about it and give it to him. And then I turned around and then Isaac's doing this. And then he looked at me and said, it doesn't work. And so we had to have this conversation about how do you give things to God? And the rackets about giving to God come by the fact that God's work is always mediated through human agencies. And so there are lots of things. Oh, yeah, we can give notionally to God, but the idea of giving to those human agencies, there are lots of rackets that we run. So, you know, well, I'm not sure what they do with their money, so I don't want to give to it. Or I don't like what they do with their money, so I don't want to give to it. Or, you know, they don't tell me what specific things need to be given to. And, there are whole loads of things which we can actually just need to catch ourselves with and say, do you know what? We're not being honest with ourselves about that. One of the problems with giving money is that it's always secretive. And Jesus addresses that at the end of the passage when the Pharisees were sneering at Jesus for this teaching. Because remember, they thought that you got rich because God was blessing you. And so, you know, they were disdainful of what he was teaching here, that there were kind of two rival gods. They saw it a completely different way. And these Pharisees, they tithed everything. They even tithed their herbs and spices. But God looked right at through their hearts. And Jesus said that to him. He sees everything about you. It's not a secret to God. And he has that phrase there in that passage about what people most aspire for is detestable for God. One of the things that makes money and giving a powerful problem for many of us is its secret nature. Linda was telling us recently that she went to a church in New Orleans where you get handed your notice sheet at the start, and the notice sheet has a list of everybody who's giving in the church and how much they give each month. Don't worry, we're not thinking about it. But one of our elders said to me recently, I'm thinking about needing to become accountable for my giving. And I want to go and talk to, and he named somebody in the church and said, I don't want it to be a secret. I want to be accountable for it. It's a general principle in life that sin thrives in secrecy. And maybe for some of us, the challenge right now is to stop being secret about our giving and be accountable to someone about it. Whatever you do, don't talk to me. It will corrupt me. Depending on how much you give, you might be my friend or I might never talk to you again. I'm joking. But honestly, I don't know what anybody gives and I don't want to. That would be too much information. But it set me thinking, who knows what I give, apart from Keris? How do, you know, who else knows? How do I be accountable for this? And so I'm going to talk about that with my spiritual director. Who knows what we give? Sin thrives in secrecy. God knows our hearts. Maybe there's a message here about transparency so that we can take it this the next step in terms of let's be free from this rival God and let's start being honest with ourselves. And the last thing is this, that faithfulness with money will be rewarded. Now, if we were in certain denominations right now, this is where the preacher gets really excited. And he starts to say, God is no man's debtor, which is absolutely true. And he will say, and freely you will receive and freely give. Those two things go together, and that is absolutely true. And then he makes the connection and says, so you give in the offering now, and you'll see much more financial reward come into your life. And all over the internet and all over the God channel, you will see and hear this preaching. It's called prosperity gospel, that you give God money and he will bless you materially. And, you know, they take some verses from the Old Testament. Wouldn't that be great? But actually what Jesus is on about is something even greater. As he says, so if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? There's all the difference in the world between worldly wealth and true riches. And what the reward is that God promises a reward for those who are faithful with money. There will be spiritual riches. There will be true riches. There will be knowing God, growing God, an inheritance in God. It's not prosperity gospel, but it is absolutely a reward. Those who learn generosity grow closer to God. We cannot worship God and grow in him without being generous. So there we have it. Those four principles. Whether we live in Calcutta or in the affluent West, when we're a Christian wanting to make money, see God's kingdom come, there are four principles that transcend our culture. We are stewards, not owners. Money is a rival God. Money is all a question of honesty and honesty with ourselves, for starters. And number four, principle number four, faithfulness with money will be rewarded. I want to show you a video clip. I don't ever want to be uncritical of what I watch on TV. And there are many things wrong with the clip that I'm about to show you. So please don't come and lecture me afterwards. I know there are a lot of things wrong with this clip. Okay, we all got that? Yeah. Okay. But there is something here which speaks of a timeless principle of the kingdom of God. See if you can guess what it was. I ought to say, just for, can you just freeze that? Thank you very much. So this is a clip from a series called The Undercover Boss. So what happens is a boss of a multinational goes in disguise to work in the workplace alongside colleagues. Sometimes the disguises are so good that when the boss comes in and meets them, you know, months later, they don't even realize who he was. And it can make hilarious TV because some of them are very rude to their boss on the shop floor
and then meet him face to face and are terrified. One boss said, "What did you think of that guy, George?" And the employee said, "Oh, he wasn't up to much. I wouldn't hire him." We're talking, you know, people who are, you know, heads of multinationals. The clip we're about to see is a man who has been undercover in his chain of fast food restaurants. And he's seen some things and he wants to respond to it. We just got one clip and it stops about 2.5 minutes in. Thanks. So, have we got our heads around the fact that God is no man's debtor? That money is a rival God? That we're stewards of everything we have? And that it's all a question of honesty? Because if we have, one day we will hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And we will understand that we are rewarded. In a couple of weeks, we've got the baptisms, and then there's another week. But then I'm going to come back to this because I think there are some massive things about how we work from the basis of these principles into the financial crisis which is looming in our country and is going to get worse before it gets better. But that'll be for another time. Why don't we stand and pray? And then we're going to have some coffee together.